Hello, 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 and welcome to the My Empty Hand podcast, our conversations in Kenpo, and we're just going to chit-chat and talk about Kenpo and whatever else happens to come our way. I am Reggie Darden, and today I have with me Ted Subner. I am really excited to be able to chat with you and just find out about your journey, find out about your story. Just real quick, kind of my brief history. I started in Kenpo in the mid-90s. I started at what was essentially a Tracy school. And actually I believe we are in the same lineage, but we'll talk about that. I trained at that school for about 3 years. Then I left for the Army, did a little bit of Taekwondo and Hapkido and boxing. After the military, I got involved in Capoeira and been doing that for coming up on 17 years. And currently I'm training at a Kenpo school that I've been at for I guess about 2 or 3 years as well. Just recently got my green belt, and so just moving right along and enjoying that, and just excited to get to chat with you. So if you could go ahead and let us know how Kenpo found you, how you got started, and just take it.
Okay, well. Let's see, going back to early on, I was very interested in boxing. I boxed at the YMCA. My coach there thought I was pretty good. And I grew up in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area in San Jose. And so he sent me over to San Jose State to work with their boxing team. At the time, they were coached by Julie Menendez and were the NCAA champions. Went to his camps, and he thought I had some promise. He was grooming me for a scholarship, wanted me to box for him there at San Jose State when somebody was killed in competition and the NCAA dropped collegiate boxing altogether. And so that was the end of that. In the meantime, my eighth grade school teacher, Dave Cardenas, he was a Korean War veteran. He had been pretty badly wounded. He was also a big boxing fan. And so, he kept boxing gloves in the back of the classroom, and he'd put everybody to work reading one chapter and pull me and another guy back there, and we'd go through boxing technique. Well, I was wrestling at the time in high school, stopped by to see him after school, and this was in 1963. And he told me, forget about boxing. There's something new I'm doing. You gotta see this. He started showing me some Kenpo techniques, and I said, I got to do this. Mm-hmm. So I got a hold of my best buddy at the time, Rick Harper. And we convinced our parents to let us enroll at the Tracy's new school in San Jose. And that's when we started training.
Right on.
I continued on with it. He dropped out of brown belt. I continued to train. I gave up, sports and everything else in high school. Never got to wear a Letterman sweater, but I got to wear a black belt. So continued on. Like you, I had to go into the military. At the time then, the Tracy's were franchising schools all over the country. At one point, Fortune 500 reported that we had more millionaires under 30 years of age than any company in America. I mean, people were just flocking to the schools to learn it. And they wanted me to open a school. I said, hey, I'm draft bait. I'm going to be in the Army, at some point. So I stayed behind and I wound up being their head instructor. At 19 years old, I was their head instructor.
Oh, wow.
And then as luck would have it, they decided to make the draft more fair. In 1969, they started the lottery and I drew number 5. So, it was time. I had to go do my time. When I came back, I continued to teach as a head instructor at the Santa Clara school. The Tracy's had moved to Seattle And we still had people coming into the Bay Area to train with us. A lot of the school owners who needed, they'd been fast-tracked and they needed further training. Just continued on until, always taught at other people's schools, went into law enforcement, worked as a police officer, well, as a deputy sheriff in the main jail for a while. And then the atmosphere of incarceration was just toxic to my soul. So I moved on to San Jose Police, worked there for 12 years. Finally, in 1988, I opened my own school in San Jose and ran that until 2012 when my wife and I moved to Austin. And I'm living in Texas now. So,
okay. All right. Excellent. I'm in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So
along the way, not only studied, you know, with the Tracys, continued my boxing. Julie Menendez, who was the coach at San Jose State, he also coached the 1960 Olympic team, coached Muhammad Ali then Cassius Clay, to a gold medal. And then again in 68, coached George Foreman to a gold medal. So he was two-time coach there. While I was at San Jose State, our judo team was the NCAA champion. Out of 13 weight classes, we had 11 national champions under Yoshi Ishida. And I could get PE credits. So I took judo 4 days a week while I was at San Jose State for 2.5 years. Got a brown belt in judo. It didn't interest me. Nothing like Kempo always did. Mm-hmm. But then in 1990, I met Professor Sig Kufroth, who was the top student of Professor Henry Okazaki, the progenitor of Danzenru Jiu-Jitsu in Hawaii. And what I wanted from him was the healing arts. There was a lot of talk about Matosi's healing arts, but nobody knew it. Nobody knew anything about it. Nobody could teach me anything. And I contacted Professor Kufroth, who lived not far from me. And he said, yeah, Matosi did the healing arts, you know. Ours are better, of course, you know. So I spent the next 10 years learning his Danzenru Jiu-Jitsu as well as his Seppuku Jitsu healing arts. And he unfortunately died in 1990, or rather 2000 at the age of 90. An excellent instructor. So I did have, you know, I was well-rounded in the martial arts.
So when you first were introduced to Kempo, like what stood out or what, you know, attracted you to the art?
Well, that's very simple. When I wrestled, a bigger, stronger, more skilled wrestler always beat me. When I boxed, a bigger, stronger, faster boxer always beat me. But when I started learning Kempo, I found out I had 1,000 ways to beat anybody. You want to fight like this? Okay, I'll fight like this. It gave me so many tools. The only limit on it was what I put on myself. Kempo was so versatile. It just leveled the playing field against any opponent. And, you know, I was just drawn to it. Never could.
Excellent. So just to kind of, I guess, see how our kind of lineages go. So my instructor was Pete Salas. His instructor was Ornette Chicken Gabriel, and before that was Dick Willett, and then
right.
Dick Willett was a student of the Tracys. So,
yeah, we had two schools in the Bay Area at that time when they started. Well, we had three. They started their school in '62 in San Francisco. Then they opened a school in Sacramento and San Jose, and one in San Mateo. The San Mateo school was taken over by a man named Ray Klingenberg. And that's where Dick Willett studied. And that group that came out of there, they were all, you know, great competitors, great fighters. Mm-hmm. In 1968, we both got our black belts. I went in the Army after that, and Dick mm-hmm. went to Sacramento, where he opened his schools. Okay. And that's where Chicken studied. Okay. So that's the lineage you came out of there.
Okay. Yeah, I have Not really, you know, heard a lot about that kind of that side of the lineage. So, I certainly want to know more and certainly want to, you know, connect with kind of the people of that era.
Well, they're certainly around. I'm on their board of directors. They honored me by asking me to be part of their board of directors. So we were meeting fairly regularly. COVID changed everything. I mean, we haven't found our equilibrium and our norm since COVID. I mean, everything's been kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Dave Hayes and Todd McElhaney still runs the school in Sacramento at the same place where Dick Willett had it for 45 years. So, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're certainly still alive and kicking.
Yeah, I've actually had little chats with both of them in kind of the last few months as I've been trying to kind of you know, although I'm training at, you know, a Ed Parker you know version school, I'm still kind of trying to keep up with my previous training. And kind of doing a, I don't know, compare, contrast, and just, I don't know, I guess I'm sort of a completionist. I originally had the idea when I started training Kenpo again, I kind of had the original idea to kind of quote unquote, go back and finish my training and get my black belt. I was a green belt when I left originally. And so I wanted to kind of go back through and, you know, see what I still remember. I, you know, I found my old book and was still going through the techniques and the forms and stuff. And
good.
Got some videos and stuff of the techniques. Although Mr. Salas, he doesn't. So when I came up, it was 40 techniques per belt.
Right.
He now teaches at 20. So having to kind of fill in the gaps a little bit here and there, but you know, I'm still kind of interested in that side of it, and you know, want to kind of continue to kind of preserve it. So you know, that's oh yeah, I just, sorry,
I had an
seen a little message here about something on the recording, so just
Well, Tracy's is a difficult curriculum. I mean, there's no question about it. It's, you know, you don't cakewalk into a black belt. You got to earn it, but it's worth it. It's well worth it. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've heard people say that I've taught over the years, oh, well, you know, I've got to put my training on hold for now. You know, I'll finish this later. Nah, don't do that. There's no time like the present. There will never be a better time. You will never be more ready to do it than you are right now. So don't put it off. Don't find a way to fit it into whatever your life consists of at this particular time is my advice to anybody when it comes to their Kenpo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So something that I've been kind of always curious about and trying to, I guess, find a way to get this gently and make sure that we don't step into too much drama and controversy. But I've always been curious about, I guess, I don't know, split or just the kind of difference in the trajectory between, you know, the Tracy's version and kind of the Ed Parker, you know, version of, you know, evolution. Is there anything you can kind of speak to as far as just...
Absolutely. I was right there in the middle of it. I mean, what do you want to know?
I mean, well, I guess first, you know, from your side of it or what you were exposed to, I mean, was there kind of, you know, bad blood or I guess what was the reasoning between from going in the different routes?
Well, the Tracys were very, very organized, very businesslike, and they brought in a man named Tom Connor, who came from the Arthur Murray dance schools. And I don't know if you know anything about Arthur Murray's, but back in the 50s and 60s, they were a fabulously successful franchise of dance instruction schools. And what they, their success stemmed from their process of teaching private lessons. And the Tracys found that they could produce a much more efficient student with greater and more rapid transfer of knowledge and skills in private instruction than in group instruction. And you got to remember, we were the only second generation to learn this art in our own language. Before that, we were learning it in a foreign language, and it was very difficult. A lot of things don't translate out. I know that when I've worked with my school, used to host the full contact Nippon Kempo team from Osaka University. Their coach was Susumu Matsumura, who was a mathematics professor, is a friend of mine, and he brings team over every summer. And there were certain things that he tried to explain to me, and it would go on and on and on. And he'd turn to one of his students, he'd say a few things in Japanese, and bang. They knew right what he meant. So suddenly now we're learning it in our own language. And the private lesson format turned out to be very, very successful. And the Tracys then realized that if they were going to do that, there had to be an organized curriculum, very much like what you have in college. Up to that time, you go into group class and it was whatever they wanted to teach at that time. You didn't have the educational schema, which said, okay, you learn, you know, two techniques and three movements in your kata in your private lesson. So they took and they created the manuals, the curriculum, just like a college course. You know, you learn 40 techniques, two katas, then you're tested on it, just like you are in college, and you're promoted and on you go to the next course. And they presented this to Ed Parker, and said, look, this is what we've done. You're welcome to use our stuff. Whoa, man, Ed didn't like that. Mm. He was concerned Kempo belonged to him. Mm-hmm. So business-wise, the Tracys went their own way, and he went his way. There was no bad blood. As a matter of fact, I mean, Jim Tracy, the younger brother, was my instructor. He had tremendous respect for Parker and referenced him a lot. Al talked to Parker at least once a week, right up until the week he died. I'll talk to him just a couple days before he left for Hawaii. So a lot of the stuff coming out of that, and I'll say this, people can deny it if they want, but there were a lot of people who tried to ingratiate themselves to Parker by running down the Tracys publicly. Mm-hmm. The fact that Parker did not stand up and say, hey, no, that's not true, Al's feelings were really hurt by that because they were friends. And so Al responded by attacking Parker, which was not the best thing to do, and earned the ire of a lot of Kempoists all over the world. And that naturally, Parker being the senior guy, you know, they looked down on Al as being the student attacking his instructor. And all he was doing in his mind was defending himself. That all kind of came to an end with the internet. I put up a discussion forum for my students to use so that they wouldn't have to wait until their next lesson to get a question answered. That was the purpose of it. It turned into a battleground between Parker's people and our people. And I realized these guys who are, you know, I'm listening to, they didn't know a damn thing. These were younger guys, and it was obvious they were trying to ingratiate themselves and impress the more senior guys. Well, the older guys who knew me and we'd come up together, started telling them, hey, you're way off, you know, you're going to get in trouble. You better watch it. You better shut up. And then people like Bob White started inviting me to their events and things. And pretty much the rifts were healed. You know, I'm on Jeff Speakman's board of directors. Mm-hmm. I used to attend Bob White's Royal Family Kids Camp tournament every year. You know, that all got kind of taken care of. Now, as far as how we move, there's no question. Tracy's, we move a little bit differently. And that is because at one point, Al was working for the state of California, and across the street from where the office was on MacArthur Boulevard in Los Angeles was a school owned by one of Masayama's students, a guy named Jerry Driscoll, And so Al studied Kyokushinkai there for a while. And that's where Tracy's people get the low, strong stances, you know, that really hard, powerful reverse punch that, you know, you don't see it quite as severely in Parker Kempo as you do in Tracy Kempo. So that's where those are just minor differences. Mm-hmm. You know? So, but I mean, hey, you know, to say we're all one big happy family. No.
Yeah.
My heritage is Scotland. The only time the Scots aren't fighting somebody else is when they're fighting each other, you know. I mean, where there's 6 degrees of separation in life, in Kempo, there's two. I was invited to John Sepulveda's school to sit on his promotion board one time. And he had 24 guys. 22 of them were testing for higher rank in black belt, and then two were going from brown to black. And at one point, he stopped everybody and said, okay, well, you know, let's take a break, you know, get our breath and, you know, tell us, you know, your lineage, who you studied with and this thing. 18 of them had either studied from my students or one of my students' students. That's mm-hmm. how closely we're all related. Mm-hmm. You know, so people getting all shook up about a Parker Tracy rivalry. There isn't one. If there is, it's in their head.
Yeah.
And if they're all shook up about it, that's probably the only thing in their head, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So kind of, so over the years, like how has the system, you know, changed, evolved? There's been, you know, other arts or other things that have kind of gotten integrated to it as, you know, MMA and, you know,
that was a natural
jiu-jitsu and things like that.
Those things were natural. You got to remember, jiu-jitsu is a natural part of our art. The Chinese martial arts were developed. Well, you got to remember, all our part of China was under subjugation by foreign powers throughout its history. The first and the Orientals, being very suspicious people, first thing they did was disarmed the military aristocracy. And so in China, they responded by training in secret in empty-handed combat, not self-defense like the jiu-jitsu in Japan was. Ultimately, these Chinese arts made their way to Japan, where they were rapidly embraced by the samurai, who were a warrior class. Now, you got to remember, Japan has only lost one war in its collective history, and it took two atomic bombs to finish it. So they're tough, resilient people, and having never been subjugated like the Chinese, they practiced the art quite openly. Now then, with the restoration of the emperor and the fall of the shogunate in early 1860, they outlawed Kempo in Japan. It was decided that it was just a killing art. And so it went underground, and then it resurfaced at the beginning of World War II when the Matosi family brought it to Hawaii. And then with Emperor Otto and Chow, and then ultimately Parker bringing it to the mainland, it just flourished. Mm-hmm. So being that it started from the secret Chinese art, and those were family arts also, different families did it differently. The tradition of the priests and it being practiced in the temples, well, that was a natural upthrust. Throughout the Middle Ages, all noble families would donate one son to the priesthood, whether it be, you know, in Europe, the Catholic Church. There were only so many resources a family had, and the oldest son usually received everything. So wasn't that much for the rest of the family. They had to find something for him to do. So they dump one of them into the priesthood, you know, that was just mm-hmm. natural. Well, in China, it was a little bit more organized. He was tasked with carrying on the family's fighting art. And like I say, when it moved to Japan, the samurai embraced it again, different families. So you had different styles and different things got integrated here and there until we got to where we were in the 1940s, when Matosi started teaching it, well, to his own family and then later to to the general public. And then it was, you know, just like I say, it just flourished. Now then, as far as MMA and that kind of thing, you know, we didn't have a point sparring sport aspect of Kenpo. We borrowed that from the Japanese. And I remember in the early days, all of the tournaments were put on by the Shotokan people or the Shintaro people. And they didn't like us. They considered us a rogue art. The fact that we did things that they considered illegal, that was just, you know. But we then Parker started the internationals. And that opened it up to everybody. And we started getting some fair officiating at that point. And then you started seeing open tournaments, when they called open tournaments. But I mean, I got disqualified from so many tournaments. you know, I couldn't get the concept. Being a Kenpo guy, I couldn't get the concept of limited fighting, like what point fighting is. And so I did things that then they thought were, well, they were illegal. And they would disqualify me. In many cases, they threw me completely out of the building. I didn't know any better. You know, when they finally, the Tracys brought in Joe Lewis, the great, you know, tournament fighter, and he taught us then how to compete on that level. The unfortunate thing is some people took and made that then their art, and you try using point fighting for self-defense, and you're like fighting standing on one leg with one arm tied behind your back. You are not using all your best weapons. You've got to train everything with everything you got. And that's the power of Kenpo. Like I say, it didn't matter who my opponent was. I could find a way to beat him because we had so much that we can use against anybody. But it was very natural then that we evolved that forward, which, you know, we were the ones that started it there in San Jose. We started putting on wrestling shoes and boxing gloves and going full power. I started wearing them because in judo, when we'd Rondori, I always got a national champion because they knew I was a black belt in Kenpo for my partner. And they couldn't throw me, so they got pissed. And they'd start going to the ankles for the sweeps. And, man, they hit hard. That's like getting a snap kick to your ankle. And my ankles turned bright purple. And I started wearing those leg stockings that old ladies wear for varicose veins. And then one day they were tearing some mat up at the school. And my ankles were just singing to me. So I cut up some mat, stuck it down into the stockings, went over and kicked the bag and didn't feel anything. So I kicked the door frame. Then the next, and this is how it was in those days, the next poor dummy who walked in the door, I kicked him. And I don't want to spar. Well, you're going to, you know. And then I was making those things for everybody. And people were saying, well, you got to patent this, you know. I said, who wants these? Just some martial arts guys, you know. And then I went in the Army. I came out, and Jun Ree, who just some little Korean guy teaching in Texas, he had patented my idea and was a millionaire. So turn the other way and somebody makes money on your ideas.
Yeah.
But that was that was going to happen anyway.
Yeah. So in, you know, these interviews and whatnot, always get the perspective or the story of folks after they get their black belt. I'm curious if you have any kind of memorable moments that stand out before you got your black belt, when you were a colored belt. Is there, you know, a story or two that just kind of stands out as you know, fun or interesting or?
Sure. Let me, if I may, just go back to what we were just talking about, just finish that point, is, you know, new trends come in, you know, MMA is real big. But over the years, I've noticed that the people who then forego their traditional training and start training in just something new, they lose all the fundamental parts of the art and they wind up being ineffective. You gotta be able to hack the traditional art. And you got to learn it from the bottom up. But going back to what you asked, when I was a green belt, I got a couple of stories for you. So I was sitting, waiting for the group class to start on Saturday morning, and a guy named Steve LeBounty, who anybody in American Kenpo will remember that name. He was one of our black belts, before he started with Parker. And he and a guy named Jim Trevino, they called him the Animal, they were going to spar. And I had never seen, I was 14, I'd never seen two grown men at that close range really going at it like that. And there were three things that I got from that. One, they aren't doing anything I couldn't do. I could do everything they were doing. Second, in many cases, I was a better athlete than either of those guys. And third, I don't ever want to be around that level of violence again and not be part of it. So then 5 years later, Oda was holding the World Team Championships in San Jose, and he asked Al Tracy if he could train at our school in the evening. At that time, we had 600 students. We were the largest single art school in the world. I mean, the Kodokan in Japan, but that was multiple arts. And he came over one night, and he and Al were at the end of the mat. We were having sparring class. And in those days, you'd come in, you'd bow in, go through the warm-ups. Everybody would sit down. And then two guys would get up, fight for 2 minutes, you know, sit down. And two more guys. So if you were lucky, you know, you'd fight twice. If you were lucky, you got a third match. You'd fight 6 minutes. So they got me and a guy named JT Will, who a lot of people will remember from, he was big in the MMA stuff as an official referee. He was there on a football scholarship to play at San Jose State. And he didn't want Tat Kubota thinking we were sissies, you know. So he turned up the volume and we went at it, man. There was blood and spit flying everywhere. And it was very reminiscent of LeBounty and Trevino 5 years before. When we were finished, we were laughing. And Kubota turns to Al and he says, "This is not kumite. This is thuggery." And it takes a lot to impress Kubota. You know, he was a pretty tough guy. Then later that year, in those days, we would go through testing on an individual basis, and then the Tracys would have a big banquet, and people would get promoted. That way, nobody knew who tested, and so if you didn't get promoted, well, you know, it wasn't embarrassing because, you know, I didn't test yet. Parker came up, and he taught the morning class, and then my training partner, Ricky Harper, and I were going to be in the demonstration with him that night. And so he spent several hours, taught us the two-man set, which we did. He went through my book set, which I was going to do, and then he taught us each three demo techniques, and we were in the demonstration with him that night, and that was when I was promoted to brown belt. But at one point, I did the breaking, and Al broke, and Parker was just, he was sitting to my side, not more than three, four feet from me, when I hit the boards, and it was a bad break. My focus was off, and the middle board split and flew out the side, right at his face, like a rocket. And Parker was sitting there staring at me, and he just, boom, flicked the board out of the way. Casual as hell. You know, and then he was still watching, and he looks up at me like, "Get with it, kid." Well, on I went with it, you know.
Very nice, very nice. So looking at, you know, the training, you know, you've been in the art for a long time. Is there anything?
51 years next month.
Oh, wow. Nice. Very nice. Is there anything that you see, or maybe something that you used to do, or training that used to happen that maybe isn't happening these days? You know, is there a change maybe that you would like to see happen, as you know, as the art goes forward, or maybe is there something that is happening now that you wish, you know, was happening when you were coming up? Is there kind of anything like that?
Well, when I was coming up, we didn't have children, we didn't have kids. I was the kid. Started just before my 14th birthday, 13 years old. And they didn't cut me any slack at all. Most of the students were veterans, either Vietnam or Korea. Vietnam was escalating at the time. And these guys were serious. Very, just deadly serious about the art they were learning. They wanted it to be effective. And they would push the limits as far as it was safe to get as much reality as they could out of it. Padding changed a lot of the things in the way we train. My students will train with pads on, but then at some point they're going to take the pads off because they're going to learn there's consequences. You can hurt yourself as badly doing this incorrectly as you can doing it with pads on.
Gotcha. Oh, no problem.
And then, you know, it became a big thing with children. Like I said, I gave up everything. I gave up, you know, sports in high school. But it's become kind of it's something we do between Little League and soccer or ballet and tennis. And it's much more serious than that. In 1932, Jigoro Kano, the founder of judo, the Olympics were held in Los Angeles at that time, and he came over and he addressed the Olympian and put on a judo demonstration. And I have a transcript of the address he gave to the Olympian. And what he said was, you know, the overall physical health of a population, you know, physical education is a very important part of it. And the best physical education for a population is martial arts. And that is because, one, it trains all aspects of the body, but two, there's a secondary value to everything you do. So unlike badminton or volleyball, there's no secondary value, whereas with martial arts, there is, and that is self-defense. And along with self-defense comes self-esteem. And it's very easy to overlook the importance of that because they instill a false sense of self-esteem with participation trophies, belt test every month. I had one guy come into my school. He was a fifth degree orange belt. I mean, come on, you know, but he got a promotion every month. That's false self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And though it can serve you, it can fail you also. A high level of self-esteem is important. And martial arts will give it to you, but a false sense of self-esteem will get you into trouble. So I would like to see a lot of these commercial schools, particularly that are teaching children, get a little more serious about it. Make sure that they're learning the things they need to learn. These Taekwondo schools, one of the things they should be teaching those kids is how to fall.
I am so with you on that. Falling should definitely be taught early and often.
From a personal standpoint, you know, the 60 years I've been in the martial arts, I've fallen down a lot more times than I've ever had to fight. Mm-hmm. I've fallen down stairs. I've slipped on, you know, ice. You got to know how to fall. My own father fell at the age of 80, coming down a flight of stairs, had trifocals on, thought there was another step. It caused him to trip. The fall wasn't that bad, but because he did it incorrectly, it snapped his neck, and he lived out the rest of his life as a quadriplegic. The other thing is you hear all the jiu-jitsu guys, you know, anywhere from 60 to 90% of all fights go to the ground. Mm-hmm. That may be, but I can't speak to that statistic, and everybody knows that 87.4% of all statistics are made up on the spot. But the simple fact is 50% or more of those fights end right then because somebody's disabled or hurt badly by the fall. And if you know how to fall, you protect yourself from injury. I don't want to see anybody wind up the way my father wound up. You know, a man, you know, with that much vitality, just sitting in a wheelchair. If he wanted to puff off a cigar, somebody had to hold it for him. Just, you know. Terrible way to end your life. So I'd like to see them take that a little bit more seriously, teach them some grappling skills while they're younger. And I found that when I teach adults really struggle with falling and rolling, whereas kids, it's real easy to teach them. So teach them while they're young. Then those skills are already there when they get old enough to be taught the what I consider to be the lethal aspects of our art. And that shouldn't start until about 14 or 15. They just don't have the responsibility. So those are the changes I would like to see.
Yeah, no, I'm so with you on that. So, you know, I study Capoeira as well, and saw a video recently of, you know, there are a lot of sweeps and takedowns in Capoeira, and was watching a video of a match, and a lady just got wasn't a very hard or aggressive sweep, but when she fell, I mean, her head just hit the ground. That was the first thing that hit the ground, and it just really, really shook me on just all it takes is falling on your head, and that's the end of things.
I don't know if you watched that football game last night, but they did a quick recap on some of the injuries to the Miami Dolphins quarterback. Mm-hmm. And every one of them, I mean, they slammed him. The fall wasn't that bad, but his head then slammed over and hit.
Yeah.
You know, they haven't learned how to tuck the head, protect the head. Mm-hmm.
It's huge. All right. So got a few little kind of fun questions as we head towards closing out for today. First one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Well, yeah. I would say for its versatility and the times I've used it, the manner in which it overwhelmed the opponent, and that would be slashing cougar.
Oh, yes. I like that one.
I love that double claw, and it can be done, with them separated or as a unified body movement. Extremely powerful and devastating. Other than that, one I've used a lot because when I was in law enforcement, occasionally people would charge you, particularly if they were bigger and stronger, was arcing blades.
Oh, okay.
Closing up with that kick to the groin, that stops. I mean, a 250-pound man will stop like he hit a brick wall as soon as he's struck in the groin and his hips go backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you own it,
Exactly. Fantastic.
And then, of course, headlock, which everybody tries to get in a headlock. Headlock A, which is probably the most effective defense against a headlock we've got.
Gotcha. Excellent. Do you have a favorite form?
Well, let me clarify here. I'll say yes, long four as Kempo forms go.
Mm-hmm.
That was without a doubt Ed Parker's just absolute masterpiece. But for overall training, the book set.
Yes.
The book set. And when you've studied the healing arts, you realize, people always ask me, well, what are those movements at the beginning? That's part of the healing aspect of the kata, because those big movements are massaging the lymph nodes in the armpits and in the elbows that causes then to stimulate the immune system and begin the healing of the body, which is an important aspect of that. Then you go into the fundamental parts and then actual techniques in that kata. A beautiful kata.
I like it. So if there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
Fictional or non-fictional? Well, for lessons in life, if it could be anybody, it would be Christ. Maybe he could get me back on track and straighten my ass out. But as far as martial arts, most people would say Bruce Lee. I don't think he had that much to offer. And again, you say fictional or non-fictional, Bodo Hudhama, the founder of martial arts.
Mm-hmm.
Why not get it right from the beginning?
Mm-hmm.
I like it.
Very good. And, so then the, last little, thing that I have here. So Ed Parker was a big fan of jokes and whatnot. So, Do you have a joke that we can close things out with?
One of my favorite martial arts jokes is, how many Kenpo guys does it take to change a light bulb? Takes 1,000. One to change the light bulb and 999 to say, that's not the way Mr. Parker taught it to me.
Perfect. That's perfect. All right. Well, I thank you so much for
did you want to have a word from me there? You want to have a word from Mr. Hopper here?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Oh, are you going to interview him next week? Come over and say
yes, hi. And we can come in and say hello. Hello.
Well,
hello.
We got to get his ugly mug in here so that there's a contrast. How good.
No, I'm so glad that you could be here with us, and I guess we're chatting next week, I believe. So yeah, looking forward to it. And
me too.
Yes, thank you.
All right.
All right. Well, was there anything else that I wanted to mention or anything
Look, before we I could out? Talk about martial arts and Kenpo all day long. I could tell you stories all day long. I could tell you things that have happened, you know, but we got to cut it off somewhere.
Yeah, no, I definitely could, you know, hear stories and share stories and stuff for days on end. So, you know, we'll definitely have to get you back for part two and three and four and all that at another time. But yeah, I thank you so much for being on, and I will let you know when this is ready to come out pretty soon. And you just have a wonderful day, and
you as well.
Thank you again,
and thank you. You take care of yourself.
You too.
All right. Good luck on your training.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.